survived for decades in a notoriously insecure profession as the television sports anchor. Growing up in Iowa, he was an all-state basketball player in high school, good enough to get a scholarship to Iowa State. He quickly transferred, though, and wound up at Northern Iowa, where he played for two seasons, and then it was off to the real world. He started in radio, moved on to television in Peoria, Illinois, and then landed a job in Indianapolis in 1969. He lasted for 40 years, including a part-time role at the end of his career, surviving a firing, not to mention all those encounters with Bob Knight. The son of a Lutheran minister, he was exceedingly polite, but he had a blunt style, too, and didn't back down from conflict. Whatever he did, it must have been good, because he set a record for longevity that will likely never be broken. We got a lot of ground to cover, so let's go. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Don Hine.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Well, today's One-on-One comes to you from the fifth floor studios at MS Communications. Down on the circle, we're here with a local broadcast legend, Don Hine. We've already talked for about 10 minutes off the air. We should have been should have had recorded that as well, because we just had some good conversation.
Legend, a euphemism for old.
I won't say that. But you were, how many years were you on Channel 13?
40.
Now, that has to be the record, right, for a local sportscaster? Has to be.
I hope it's a record rather than a pretty good average. I suppose Carnegie was there for a long time at Channel 6, but not as a sports guy. He would come in and do things.
Right, right, yeah. So that's, that in itself is a major accomplishment. And
you know, Mark, nobody will ever do that again, because they counsel people on television now, probably on radio and in the newspaper, that if you're going to be a success, you're going to stay here 3-4 years, 5 maybe. Yeah. Then you're gone. I can remember one of our news directors telling us in a meeting, "You're stupid for staying here." But I'm thinking, this is the greatest job I've ever had.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful city. That I swear our television station, Channel 13, is one of the top 5 in America. I don't know any other television station that ever gave you a pension. So it was worth my staying there 40 years.
Absolutely.
I can think of none that would.
But yeah, generally it's like being a professional coach. You're there for 3 or 4 years probably, and then if your ratings decline just a tick, you're out of there, and they're always looking for young blood, that type of thing. So
yeah,
for you to hang on, and of course we'll talk about it later, you did get let go at one point and brought back.
Oh, I did. I remember that day specifically.
We will talk about that, okay. But let's start at the beginning. Were you born in Iowa?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, my dad was a preacher, a Lutheran minister, and my wife, his wife was a homemaker. Mom was a great homemaker, and she was a school teacher.
Okay.
So I hope I got a little bit of the speaking ability from Dad, who was a very good preacher. And he also was one who would say exactly as he believed. I can remember, I wonder how this would go these days. At the end of the year, Dad would always publish how much everyone in the church gave.
He'd publish it.
He published it. We only stayed in towns about 5 or 7 years, and we were gone.
He'd embarrass people.
Oh, yeah.
So you moved around a lot within Iowa.
So like 3 or 4 times, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, big sports fan growing up. Was it like as a kid, was it your ambition to be an athlete and be in sports kind of thing?
If I thought I was good enough to play professional basketball, I would have loved to have done that. But I've always thought through my career that it's not a negative if you know what you can't do. Mm-hmm. And I was always a very good shooter, but I was not strong or fast. I had a quick shot. I had a quick step. But I knew that I wasn't good enough to play at the next level. I can remember when I went from high school to college, I had a scholarship to Iowa State. Mm-hmm. They used to give you room, board, books, fees, tuition, $15 a month. And when I got with that group, the first thing I thought of after a few practices was, I may be the worst player on this team, and I was first team All-State.
Oh, wow. So you were good.
I was a good player, yeah.
Yeah. So you were first team All-State. How did your team do? Did you win?
We lost the championship game.
Yeah.
If we would have been in Indiana, we would have been a legend, because my hometown of Waverly, Iowa, is like 7,500 people. We had 200 kids in the high school. In the semifinal, we played Sioux City Central, which was the second biggest school in the state with about 1,500 students. And in the championship game, we played Davenport, which was the biggest school in the state. So we played with them for a half. We had to play like three more games than they to reach the finals. Okay. Because it was at double A and A, and the smallest schools were B, under 100 students.
So. Yeah.
But I always thought if we could have played them again, we could have beaten them.
So, yeah, that's a Milan story then.
It is, absolutely. But in Iowa, it was just people didn't get excited about your winning a regional or, you know, a regional or district game. Yeah. You're in Indiana if you win.
Oh, sectionals were huge.
Sectional,
we got out of school for winning the sectional when I was in high school.
Yeah, so. Not so in Iowa.
Okay.
Maybe it's changed.
But you got to the final game against the biggest school.
Yes.
And hung with them for, how did you play in the final game?
The final game, not so good. Yeah. Semifinal, I was terrific.
Yeah?
Yep. We beat Sioux City Central. We were down like 12 with like 3 minutes to go. And we put a man-man pressure on them. They didn't get it over the timeline for like 6 or 7 possessions. And I was on the line with 15 seconds left, down one. And I made the first one and I missed the second one, so we had to go into overtime. But we beat them in overtime. I had 27, I think, or 29.
Nice, nice. Like okay, so you get a scholarship to Iowa State, but then you wind up transferring, right?
Yes. I transferred to Iowa State. I got calcium deposits. We didn't, in those days, you didn't have training tables. And you actually had to do your own studies. I mean, there wasn't any teachers helping you to get
through. No tutoring.
Yeah, you had to make it on your own. But I didn't think we got enough to eat in the dorm. So I would fill up on milk. I bet you had 6-8 glasses of milk a meal, and I got calcium deposits in my kidneys. And they couldn't do me any good there. So I finally told them, I said, hey, Jack, I'm going to have to leave. They said, oh, you can come back next quarter. I said, no. I'm going to go. And I ended up playing a couple years for a little Division III school in my hometown, mm-hmm. Wartburg College, a little Lutheran school, which was fun. But I got where I should have been in the first place. I played my last 2 years at Northern Iowa when Norm Stewart was the coach there. And that was the best thing that ever happened, because later in my career with Bob Knight, Knight liked Stewart. They were friends, mm-hmm. quotes.
Yeah.
And so Knight always thought that I knew a little bit about basketball. Anyway.
Well, unlike most people in sports media, you had played the game at a pretty high level. You
know, yes.
At a college level.
Which was, I thought was really cool. We went back and played Iowa State from Northern Iowa. And we had three guys on that team that originally had gone to Iowa State. And we beat Iowa State at Iowa State.
It's like their rejects beat the real team. Right?
It was.
Wow. So you had a good college career then. A good
yes,
experience.
Yes, I did. I was always a good shooter. I was 88% for my career. I held the record of consecutive free throws there for a while at 42 in mm-hmm. competition. So I was the Steve Alford of Iowa.
Socks, shorts, 1, 2,
yeah,
3.
Couldn't huh? jump worth a lick, but could shoot a little bit.
Did you have professional ambitions?
I did. I really did. I got a couple of feelers from, I remember the Chicago team specifically had sent me a questionnaire. I never did anything about it. I never tried out or anything.
Yeah.
I always thought that if I would have known about the ABA, then I could have played, because that was a shooter's league.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to be so strong at that time. But I think the NBA, I mean, really good athletes.
Yeah. When did you come out of college?
Yeah, in 64.
Okay. Yeah, that's 2 years before the, or 3 years before the ABA.
Yeah, that started in 67.
67. Hine begins a broadcasting career and quickly finds his way to Indianapolis. And immediately hits the road with the Pacers when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former Channel 13 sportscaster Don Hine. He began a broadcasting career when he got out of college at Northern Iowa, made the jump from radio to television, and wound up in Indianapolis in 1969. So happened that the station had the Pacers television contract, so he hit the road. So when did the broadcast ambition hit you?
I can still remember my English teacher as a sophomore in college. She asked me what I thought I'd like to do. I said, you know, I said, I think I'd like to be in radio. She laughed. And I started doing some radio stuff in college and just kind of went on from there. And after I got out of college, I went to the University of Iowa. I was working on my master's degree at the time in speech and English. I was going to be a teacher in college. Okay. Didn't want to teach in high school. Wanted to teach in college, so I knew I had to have my master's and got an opportunity to go to a station in Peoria. I was auditioning for the job. It was on black and white stuff, obviously, in those days in the mid-60s, 65, 66. And I had done an audition in front of an aquarium, a bunch of fish in the background. And the guys at WMBD in Peoria said, that is mainly why I got the job, because I got their attention off the fish with my presentation. So of all the dumb ways to get into television, I think that was probably.
Yeah, so you really, growing up, had no ambition for television, huh?
No. I never did. I loved music, so I started out as a disc jockey at my little station in Waverly, Iowa. It was 1,000 Water. It was a daytime. Mm-hmm. And I remember the general manager gave me an opportunity to play music in quiet time at the end of the day before they went off the air. The last hour and a half would be quiet music. And I was making $1 an hour.
He's
doing the announcing and engineers, and I started playing some Stan Kenton, the ballad style of, and some George Shearing, and I thought I was really going to get it from the GM the next day, because you played stringy stuff during that time. Yeah. So, no, he said he liked it. He liked the Kenton ballad style, and I still have that album.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the music, because you're a tuba player, right?
Yep, I still play in three bands, yeah.
Yeah? And so as a kid, was music as much a part of your life as sports? Or,
You know, not really. I can remember the time that I went in third grade. I took Mom by the hand, and I said, I want to play the drums. So we went to the music director in the summertime, and I told him I wanted to play the drums. He says, we have enough drummers. You're a tuba player. And he gave me the tuba. That's how I got to be a tuba player. And it's kind of cool, because Dad moved after a couple of years after that, and we went to a small town in Iowa, Denver, which, you know, is a whoosh, and you're through the town. But they had a lot of Lutherans there, and it was a big Lutheran church. And in the high school, I was in the high school band, in the senior band, when I was in sixth grade.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So it was a great experience when I came to my hometown, Waverly, when I was seventh or eighth grade. So it was a great experience for having done that.
So in high school, you were in the marching band the whole
bit,
huh?
The football coach and the band director used to have a little argument at the start of the football season. The football coach always won. And I would come back and play in concert band after
okay,
that.
Okay, so I was going to ask, you played other sports. You played football?
Oh, I played football, basketball, and baseball.
Uh-huh. What position in football?
In football, I was an end. And in those days, you did both ways. I mean, you played offense and defense.
Yeah.
To show you how tough I was, there was another guy on the other side by the name of Bob Miller, who passed away when he was just 42. He's a great athlete, nice-looking guy. And he was tough. I mean, he was a good player. When we went to the wide side of the field, I would exchange positions with him. So I'd have the short side of the field. He'd have the wide side in case any action actually came around that way. They used to kid me on the rest of the guys high, and you actually got your uniform dirty.
You didn't like the contact.
I was not the world's guy. I did not like to see stars. You know, you get whacked in the head. I said, why do I do that? Well, I know why I did it, because all of my friends played. And then we went from football to basketball to baseball.
And at a small school, you're kind of almost obligated to play sports if you're able.
Oh, you know, we had a bunch of, we had a bunch of great athletes.
Yeah.
We made it to the state semifinals in baseball. I was a pitcher. And I played in the summertime a little semi-pro ball.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't have enough good breaking stuff to make it on the next level.
Yeah.
I pitched in college, and that was about it.
Had your dad been an athlete?
Yes, Dad was a big guy, considered in his day. He was a tackle in college at 200 pounds.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's about right for that era. Frank Cush was a starting All-American lineman at 155 or something like that.
Well, so. At Michigan State. Yeah, he was a guard, yeah.
Did your dad put any pressure on you or want you to go into the ministry? Or
you know, they talked to me about that, but with my language after that, you know, I dealt with so many athletes after that, I would have considered myself the world's biggest hypocrite. But I like that kind of thing. I like to persuade people to my way of thinking, not necessarily argument, but sometimes it gets into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't have minded to have done that at all. No.
Okay.
I like to, I'm a religious person. My wife is a very religious person. We go to church all the time. I'm liturgist from time to time, but I never thought that I could hold up as a minister.
Okay. Too many skeletons in the closet?
Oh, just a few.
Okay. So you're working for television in the mid-60s. How do you get to Indianapolis?
At that time, there was a I really was promoted by a guy who had known me that had been a sports director before in Peoria. A lot of guys went from Peoria to Chicago, Boston, big cities. Mm-hmm. And the specific guy that I remember had been in Boston working at one of the big stations there, and I can't remember the call letters anymore. But the new general manager here in Indianapolis at then WLWI was the program director at this Boston station, and he was looking at this other guy for a recommendation for a sports guy here. Apparently, the guy who was doing the Pacers at the time on television was more interested in taking his mouthpiece from his saxophone along with him on trips and sitting in than doing play-by-play.
So, who was that? Who preceded you?
Brian Madden.
Okay, that's who I thought. Okay.
Yeah, Brian Madden was the guy's name. I don't know Brian. I never heard anything that he did, but these were the stories that I got back.
And this is 1969?
1969. Yeah, two years after the ABA came in. We had the contract to do Pacer games. We had the contract to do IU games. I remember we had 10 IU games on the air. They lost every one of them. Bill Orwig, Jr., was my color man at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember one game. It must have been at Northwestern. And IU was down, as usual, at the half. And he said something about them coming back in the second half. I said, Bill, they ain't coming back. And they didn't. I mean, that was a terrible team. It was just a terrible team. And then the next year, George McGinnis
I was going to say, that just preceded George McGinnis coming in, and they were better. So what was it like doing Pacer games back in that day?
It was great. People still remember those games. I remember Roger Brown specifically. And I used to tell it as it was, kind of the Howard Cosell type, and hope I didn't get fired the next day. But I remember one game specifically, I said that Roger was really lazy on the floor. He came up to me the next day, and he said, hi, and he said, did you say that I was lazy on the floor? I said, I'm afraid I did. He said, well, you're right. He was the nicest guy. Yeah, it was a good group of guys.
Yeah.
Fun group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and Roger could be lazy, and Neto had his moments, too. And
oh, they did. I always thought that Neto Lickey had as good a hook as Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And he had a fair jump shot from 15 feet, and he could jump very well.
Oh, he's athletic, no question.
I was doing play-by at the University of Iowa when he was playing for Drake. Mm-hmm. And he was the exact same way when he played for Drake, just a lazy player. But I always liked those guys. They were, you know, we were more friends than anything.
Yeah. So, yeah, what were you doing on the road? You know, what were the road trips like with Slick and the guys?
Well, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes Slick always used to say about 6 o'clock in the morning when we'd be going somewhere, we'd stop in the airport for something to eat, and Slick would always opt for a Coney dog or something like that at 6 a.m. He says, well, you don't have a hair on your if you don't eat, then stuff it. And I said, Slick, I think I'm going to pass. Yeah. I remember one trip specifically. We went to we were going to play the Nets, and it was snowing like mad. And we landed in Newark, and all of us got in cabs at Newark to go across Manhattan. And it was snowing so hard that we couldn't make it, and we stopped at a police station. And they canceled the game. Slick says, oh, hell. He says, let's go get a case of beer and drink till tomorrow. So we went and got a case of beer.
Yeah.
It was just a kick to be on the road with that
and
group.
You go, yeah, because you're flying commercial.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're not getting on a luxury flight after the game. You're getting 4 hours or 5 hours of sleep and getting up at 6 a.m. and catching a commercial flight like everybody else.
Yep.
I have it on authority that you once left your car running at the airport in Indianapolis.
I did.
You pulled up to the curb?
This was my first Cadillac in 1973. I had never had a car before that had electric locks on it. And if you remember at that time, there were like two places at the airport where you could park, where you could stop and, you know, take your luggage and meet the the little shuttle that would take you over there. So I remember the guy that was producing for me at the time, Rick Pawson is his name. He's still in town. He'll be enjoying to hear this. I said, Rick, I said, why? The bus is coming. I said, why don't you hustle over and stop the bus? And I said, I'll park and I'll grab the, you know, our suitcases and stuff so we don't miss this bus or we'll be freezing our patoot here because it was really cold. So he hustled over and did that, and I got to the terminal. I always hated that it was terminal. Now you're going to the terminal.
Pretty final.
Yeah, I hated that. And I said, poo, I forgot my keys in the car. I said, I left them in the car. So I called up at that time. It was Tutwiler, the only car I ever bought from Tutwiler. Got the rest from Lockhart. Commercial. Okay. And he said, no problem. I said, we're going to be gone for like 4 days to Utah. And he says, no problem. He says, I'll come out and bring you the keys. Just call and you'll know where the keys are when you come back. So I find out when I come back that I had not only left my keys in the car, but I had left the car running. And luckily there was a full tank of gas in there, but the folks had come out quickly, so it wouldn't have really made any difference. So there used to, I don't know, you ever heard of the Ransburg Corporation?
Yeah.
Are they still in business? At the time, I got the Golden Yo-Yo of the Year Award for that. I told the story on the air. So that was worth the Golden Yo-Yo.
You were the Golden Yo-Yo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can't even imagine today being able to park your car
on
the curb there and getting out and doing anything. Well, so what was television like in 1969? Just the on-air part of it. You're wearing blazers. Everything's very formal. I don't know if you did videotape stuff then or not. You know, a lot of it was just reading scores, though, wasn't
right.
it?
Right. A lot of. Well, what was nice about that era was ESPN wasn't around then, so you really had to do all of the sports. So they'd give you at least 5 minutes to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
I think now they probably get a minute and a half.
Yes.
Maybe.
It's shorter, yeah.
They'll probably do a feature segment in 1/2 hour of the show and then come back and maybe do a half. You probably have to be more local now because you just don't have enough time to do anything.
Yeah.
But then you could really cover the spectrum.
Yeah.
I used to give hockey scores then, and I don't know how many people at that time would even care about hockey.
You had
scores.
5 minutes to fill.
Yeah, you had 5 minutes to fill. It was really cool because in those days you didn't have a prompter, and you wrote your own stuff. So that was always a godsend, having known what you had written and not having to be married to the prompter.
Mm-hmm.
If the prompter went down, watch nowadays and see how many times people panic when the prompter goes down. You know, I don't have anything. They might have an iPad or something. They don't even carry paper anymore on there.
Yeah, that's right.
But I always thought it was an advantage having learned to communicate from looking at your script and being aware of the audience out there and looking at the audience, too, and bringing them into the story. Because, you know, who can believe nowadays that you can remember, you know, a minute's worth of copy without ever looking down? Even when I had the prompter, I would look down at the copy, and so it was more natural.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. It used to be, you know, you had those papers, and when you were done, everybody would kind of stack them together and hit the table, and, you know, that was just kind of
anything
what everybody
to waste
did.
Time,
So throughout, do you mind saying what your salary was in 1969?
I came here for $14,000.
That's good money then.
Yeah, I was making in Peoria. I think I'd gotten to the zenith of what they ever paid at $10,000.
Yeah,
but it was a great experience because they let you in that market, and I always mentor kids to do that kind of a thing because they'll let you do a lot of stuff. You don't come to Indianapolis and you are a specific kind of reporter. Mm-hmm. In Peoria, I started out as a reporter photographer.
Mm.
I had never taken film before, but I learned how to shoot film. I learned how to edit film. And I always went to the older guys. There were several guys in that market that had been there for 25 years that knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
They were good writers, and you learned how to write. And come to the market and come to this market, a big market, and know what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you didn't have to learn your craft because you had learned it at the lower level.
Hine gets fired and comes out of it better than ever when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former Channel 13 sports anchor Don Hine. He was let go at one point by the station, but when the ratings plunged, old Don didn't seem so bad. Did you get along with your competition, the other sportscasters?
Always did throughout my career. I can remember when Kopik was here, and Craig Roberts was over at Channel 6. And we'd go to each other's homes. We went out to dinner together. We were always very good friends. Well, yeah. I didn't think that they were competitors. People that watched me, and those that liked them watched them.
Yeah. So what happened when Channel 13 let you go?
You know, I always wondered
what
had happened.
What year is this?
This is 1973, maybe.
Oh, I thought it was later than that.
No, because I think I came back in 75. I don't know, isn't it 75 or 77, in somewhere in there.
Okay.
But I had been there like 8 years. And our ratings were really good. I had just done a month at the Speedway. And during that time, I'm working like 90 hours a week. And I've got one guy with me. I have a photographer, and that's it. And we had just won two national awards for my racing show from STP. Used to give a couple national awards for whatever it was in racing. And we had done a couple of really good shows with just the two of us. And I remember the GM, he called me in the first week in June. And what the hell does he want to talk to me about in June? Because I usually took 2 weeks off after having worked 90 hours a week out there. And he fired me. And I said, Chris, the guy's name was Chris Duffy. I said, Chris, we've just won two national awards for our show. He said, well, if you're going to argue with me about it. So I said, you've screwed this up here so badly. I said, you're going to be number three again in about a month. And they did. And yeah. So I thought I was a little bit a part of that. But this worked out in my behalf because I never went behind his back anything to stab him. But 2 years later, he had run through three sportscasters, I think, during that time period. And he asked me if I wanted to come back. I didn't particularly want to come back. I was working for a nice architectural firm. They gave me a car. I worked Monday through Friday. I was making a nice salary. Mm-hmm. I didn't care whether I came back or not because I always thought I was a broadcast professional, not necessarily a star, mm-hmm. which many of the kids think they are now. So he asked me if I wanted to come back. I said, you know, I don't know. And so he gave me a tour of the station. They'd done a whole bunch of things. They changed it physically during that time. And so I said, you know, I'll consider it. So he called me back the next day and he says, well, what do you think? I said, tell me about what I'm going to make coming back and a couple of the other things. And he says, well, you make that. What happened was I doubled my salary. I got a no-cut contract. And that was, I kept that throughout my career. I always had a no-cut contract. Mm-hmm. I couldn't quit. They couldn't fire me.
Okay.
So good things came out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. What were you doing for the architectural firm?
I doing PR.
Okay.
At that time, the Everett I. Brown Company was the state's largest architectural engineering firm. They had offices in Dubai. And I mean, they were all over the place. They built, their specialty was building high schools. They did Ben Davis, Lawrence North, Lawrence Central, North Central, all the nice schools in the county. They mm-hmm. did, Marshall High School. I always thought that was the nicest IPS school too. Mm-hmm. But they were really good in the school business. So, you know, I set up things for them with superintendents and stuff. We flew here, flew there. I was enjoying it.
Yeah,
it was fun.
One of the things I remember, and this would never happen today, in early 70s, before Pacer games, there would be games between media members and race drivers.
Yes.
And somebody in town made these cute little uniforms for the drivers,
yes.
with racing stripes and so forth. And guys like Foyt and Rutherford and Andretti would come out and play these basketball games against media guys. I remember a picture in a paper, I have it at home somewhere, of you posing with one of the drivers who was much, much shorter, of course, because there was going to be this media driver, and it was a fundraiser for, I think, a driver who had been injured. That's just amazing to think about now, of drivers actually coming out and playing basketball before a Pacer game.
Even more so, Mark, I have a picture with Tom Binford playing in that game.
He played.
He played in that game, yeah. So,
what were those like? I mean,
they were a little bit dicey from time to time because some of the race drivers weren't exactly the most erudite basketball players.
No.
So, but they were fun. They were good for what they were.
I've seen team photos of the drivers in their uniforms, you know, posed and everything. And
yeah, I've got one of those.
You talk about a different era. You know, that's the kind of thing. That's how loose it was and how fun it was. And, you know, just a whole different atmosphere. Any particular, I know everybody who's a veteran of television has had some so-called embarrassing moments where things just went wrong. Does anything stand out in your mind?
You know, when somebody asks me that question, I always think of Wayne Fuson. You remember Wayne was the sports editor of the news?
Uh-huh.
We went to New York City. They used to have an award called the Seven Crown Awards, where Seagrams would bring in the top pros from all of the sports. And you know how long ago this was. They'd give them $10,000 to come in and do it. And with that group, they always brought in stars of the past. When we were there, it was Joe DiMaggio, Byron Nelson, Althea Gibson was there, Ralph Kiner, Alan Page, all of those people were there. And you could do a days of film. You could do all of these filmed interviews and, you know, put them in a stockpile and use them anytime.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, the next day was a fight between Ali and Norton in Yankee Stadium.
Ah, okay.
So it was kind of a nice little deal.
Yeah.
And Wayne and I were the only people there from Indianapolis. So we'd do interviews for 20 minutes or half an hour, and they'd give us a little 10-minute break. And we're standing there talking with Ralph Kiner, one of the great all-time home run hitters. Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh Pirates, ended his career with the Cubs. When he came with the Cubs, I thought with he and Hank Sauer, they'd win the pennant. They were lousy. But anyway, we're standing there talking with Ralph Kiner, and Fuson says to Kiner, he says, you know, he says, I've wondered all day who that fat lady is over there. Kiner says, that's my wife. It was Nancy Chaffee, who was a great tennis player of the time.
Yeah.
And I swear no more than a half hour later, we're talking with Alan Page. Alan Page, and Fuson says to him, he says, you know, Alan, he says, I can remember when you played in college for Minnesota. He said, I played at Notre Dame. And I said, Wayne, I'll tell you what. I said, I'm always going to remember these stories, but I'll always give you credit. And I always have.
Hine recalls the good times and the bad times with Bob Knight and talks of his tuba and tap dancing careers, too, when One-on-One continues. But first, here's Hine and Jerry Harkness broadcasting from Philadelphia on the night IU won the NCAA basketball championship in 1981.
Live by satellite from the Spectrum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Don Hine, Jerry Harkness. Jerry's been hustling his body back and forth here with just interviews. What'd you think of the game overall, guy?
Well, just about as expected, Don. No doubt it was a strategy. Dean did a good job with the talent he had, but the big play, I think, and the key strategy is moving Randy Whitman to forward.
Yeah.
And, of course, that gave the team speed, and it put Thomas at a guard who played a heck of a ball game at that position.
So, actually, at the time, it might have been a bonus for Kitchell to have gotten three quick fouls.
For this type of a game, definitely so. There's so many combinations that Coach Knight has developed, but this particular combination was good for North Carolina.
We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with Don Hine. He had his ups and downs with Bob Knight, as just about everybody did. But if he ever got stressed, he had ways of relaxing, like playing the tuba and tap dancing. I think we need an explanation. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with Don Hine. He had his ups and downs with Bob Knight, as just about everybody did. But if he ever got stressed, he had ways of relaxing, like playing the tuba and tap dancing. I think we need an explanation. It's an obligation on my part to ask you about experiences with Bob Knight, because anybody in the media who covered him at IU, myself included, has stories. So what? How was your relationship with Knight, and you know, what stories do you have from your time with him?
People always thought that I favored IU over Purdue because Knight liked me. Mm-hmm. And Knight liked me because I played for Norm Stewart in college, and he liked Stewart, so he thought that I knew a little bit about basketball anyway. People would say, well, you're friends with Knight. I said, no, I'm not friends with Knight. I said, he is a professional acquaintance. I never went out to dinner. Well, one time we went out to lunch together. I don't know why I was there during the noon hour, and he says, you ever been over to Marsh for a chicken sandwich? And I said, no, I haven't. And I was surprised that he paid, because he was notorious for not paying.
Yes, he was, yeah.
Well, anyway, I was, I can't remember exactly what happened in this situation, but I used to do a syndicated radio commentary show. And on one of those shows, I had talked about none of the players with whom I had spoken ever had a minute's fun playing for Bob Knight, which was the honest-to-God truth. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 1984, but I'm not positive, because I think he had the Pan Am team out at the Speedway at the time, and they were touring around, and they wanted to go to A.J. Foyt's garage. Dick Mittman loves this story because he was there at the time with a guy from Louisville who had heard about Knight's legendary temper and had never seen it in action. Well, all of the players there, and Hine is floating around, and Knight yells at me. Someone had told him about that I had said that on the air. Mm-hmm. And he said, who told you, you know, that? I said, well, I said, I'm not going to tell you who told me that story. I said, but it was more than five. Ooh, he got really angry. Then he told me I wasn't welcome at Indiana University anymore. I said, I could care less. I said, I've covered you for 15 years, and I said, you've never told me anything about basketball that I didn't know anyway. And we're nose to nose, and it was one of those deals, you know. Yeah. And people, I have a picture of that, and so does Mittman, by the way. He always asks me to sign the thing.
We've got a photograph of you two nose to
nose. Oh, yeah. And we've got videotape of it somewhere, too, but I don't.
Oh, you got to collect this stuff. And yeah. Put a little highlight.
Our photographer was shooting the thing. Well, the end of the story, though, is that I didn't go to IU for those 2 years, but Harkness did. Mm-hmm. He liked Hark, and so I never hurt my viewing audience from not getting IU stuff because he did it. And I never went and backstabbed Knight on the air or anything. We just didn't agree on certain things.
Yeah.
So it was, like I say, a couple years later, I can't remember, it was an Ohio State game. I think it was at the end of the year, and it was a very close game, and I think it was Jimmy Thomas who had made a steal near the end and was going in for an uncontested layup, and an Ohio State player undercut him, and he fell to the floor really hard, and Knight went out on the floor, and the official gave him a technical. Well, the next day, or the next couple of days, I did a commentary on the air, and I said, you know, that was pretty stupid, I thought, of the official, that a coach has an absolute right to go out on the floor of a hurt player. And apparently that got back to him, because I'm standing upstairs talking to the general manager secretary. I've known her for 20 years, and the GM is gone, and we're just passing the time of day, and the phone rings. She says, it's Bob Knight. I said, right. She says, no, it is. So I pick up the phone, and Knight says, you know, Hine, he says, you might not be the bleep that I thought you were. He says, you want anything from me, he says, you just ask me. So it was really cool, because that was the first year that the satellite trucks, the live stuff, came into being in television. And we were doing live anything. And our news director said, why don't you ask Knight to be live with you tonight before the Michigan State game? Well, if you know Knight, he didn't let his players speak to you. He didn't speak to anybody on game day. Mm-hmm. I called him, and he said, okay. So I do Knight Live, and I'm a hero with the media. I said, how did you get Knight to do that? I said, I just ask him.
Yeah.
And from that time on, I swear, he used to let me into NC2A stuff. I can remember one time in 87 when they were in New Orleans. Because after you won the first game, the media could not go into the practice with the team.
Right.
So I'm walking over to the Superdome with them for practice, and the guard stopped me there. He says, you can't go in there. Knight says, he's with me. I went in.
Yeah.
So I used to get interviews with him and video that nobody else got because I think he respected me from a sports standpoint. I know Calabro had Knight leave him one time, but I never had Knight leave me. I remember a funny story with Scott Hoke. Scott was over at Channel 6 at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He wasn't the lead sports
reporter. No.
But I think he was a reporter. And we had all gone down and interviewed Knight the week before. And he comes back again, and Knight is lecturing. Knight has a cold. And he is accusing Hoke of having given him the cold the week before. And we're all dying over on the side. And Hoke did not think that was funny.
No. And you also are a tap dancer, I am told.
I did. Yeah. I did do tap dancing. Ken Double, do you remember Ken Double?
Yes.
Ken Double
Channel
is a
6.
Very good organist.
Yeah.
And he would do an organ show, and I would do the kind of the in-between, the matinee interim. Mm-hmm. With my little tap dance. I always wanted to be a tap dancer when I was a kid, like in third or fourth grade. Little girl by the name of Georgia Gilchrist in Sheffield, Iowa, was a tap dancer. And I always was a little bit, she was involved in another one of my stories. She was a cute little girl. We always stood in line at the bubbler to get a drink. Very, very small school. The superintendent's office was right by the bubbler. She went by us one time after we had stood there to get a drink. And when she got the drink and afterwards, I kicked her in the behind. And the superintendent saw me do that. A guy by the name of R.R. Watson had took me in and paddled me for doing that. Mm-hmm. The next time I saw R.R. Watson, he was on the Iowa High School Athletic Association board. I opened the door to the elevator at the Savory Hotel in Des Moines, Iowa, when we're playing in the state championship. And he's in there. He says, Don, he says, you probably don't remember me. I said, Mr. Watson, I do. And this had been, you know, like from third grade until I was a senior in high school distance.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So, and tell me about the tuba. I mean, you're still playing in three groups, you say.
Still playing in three different groups. I play in one, a really good band called the Indianapolis Symphonic Band that's been around for almost 60 years. It's a group of about 60 to 80 people, depending on that time of year. We have professionals in there. I mean, it's a really good band. Mm-hmm. And then I play in another band it's called the New Horizons Band. You have to be 50 years of age to play in it. And we have one gentleman in there who's 92 that still plays the piccolo.
Oh, great.
It's a good band, too. Our director was at North Central High School for 27 years, Sam Ryan Smith. Al Spangler, who used to be at Speedway, is our associate director over there. And then we have a jazz band with that group. It's like the old dance band, the 17-piece dance band.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I mention dance, I have to include my wife because she loves ballroom dancing. So I've been taking ballroom dancing lessons.
Oh, wow.
Feel pretty comfortable with the waltz.
Yeah.
Foxtrot, cha-cha, a little bit of rumba, not so much West Coast. I'd never heard of that before. A little hustle. I can do all of those.
You're a Renaissance man.
I don't know
playing
if I'm
tuba,
a Renaissance
tap, man. Tap dancing, sports casting, you're doing it all.
I always loved music.
Yeah.
I just always loved music and started out as a disc jockey. So.
Okay.
And I used to do an hour show a month here on a little radio station in town. I no longer do it. I finally got tired of all the prep time. And you realize prep time here too. You sometimes is longer than the event itself.
Right.
People think you walk in and do it. Yeah, I walk in and do it after I've prepared for 2 hours to do it.
You were able to go out on your own terms, right, at Channel 13.
I was. You know, I just kind of
Which
faded away.
Yeah.
I thought that was very cool. I at 59 and a half, I wanted to get at my 401k, and I said, "Who knows how long I'm going to live?" But it was a great place to work. We're owned over there by the Dispatch Company out of Columbus, Ohio. They always gave us the best equipment, left us alone, as some other multimedia organizations are run from whoever.
Mm-hmm.
They always left us alone, and like I say, probably the only station in America where you could get a pension.
You retired at 59?
59 and a half.
But you had a 40-year career there, I thought.
I did. I came back from time to time, and
oh, you're including the years after, were
yeah,
you? Because you did. You would occasionally still go on the
weekends,
air with them and do
they
things,
needed a warm body to do weekend stuff, and they were still giving us 5 minutes on the weekend to do each half hour. So I was getting 20 minutes on the air for Saturday and Sunday morning.
Okay. When was your last broadcast with them then?
Let's see, 69, 09.
In 09 you were on.
Yeah.
Could you go back and do it again today?
I could do it in a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could do it. Because it's basically writing and communicating with people, and, mm-hmm. and I always thought I did that well. I'm always amazed. I'll be standing in a line at White Castle or someplace and talking to someone, and people will turn around and recognize my voice.
Sure.
And I'm always amazed at that, how attentive people are.
Yeah, well, you were in people's homes for decades.
Long time,
So they've heard the voice and seen the face for a long time. Okay, Don, I got a theme question that I've asked everybody. When you're sleeping at night, do you dream of your job? Do you dream of doing sportscasts on television, that type of thing?
I have a recurring dream that I'm a disc jockey and I can't find the next song. I know it's going to run out soon, but I can't find the next song, and I know I prepared to do it. And I've had that dream a million times.
One-on-One with Don Hine continues in a moment. Well, thanks to Don Hine for joining the One-on-One cause. Hey, you got to give him credit, right? Lasting 40 years in one marketplace like he did, even if some of it was on a part-time basis. He got out on his own terms, and that's awfully hard to do in the television business. Most any business, for that matter. I'm guessing that's a record that won't ever be beaten. Station managers come and go, and they're all going to want to put their stamp on an operation. So it's difficult to survive unless you're absolutely dominating the ratings. Nobody does that forever. As you just heard, he got fired once himself, but had the last laugh. Wouldn't we all like to be fired under those circumstances? Now, as always, if you want to hear this or any of the other One-on-One episodes, go to the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, click on the podcast link, and they're there for you 24/7. You can always reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @MarkMonteith. And I'll be back next week with a conversation with NHRA drag racing champion Antron Brown, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.